and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear once again from Sahar Khajanouri in conversation with singer-songwriter and filmmaker Pete Sands of Blackass. You can find some of his work on The Aux, the music video service of FNX, fnx.org/TheAux, A-U-X. First, though, Idlewild Arts Academy is about to be offering classes and training in virtual reality filmmaking and gaming. It'll be the only one of its kind in the country. I spoke with Film and Digital Media Department Chair at Idlewild Arts Academy, Annette Haywood-Carter.
The department was founded about 15 years ago, but within the context of the history of the school is 70 years old, so it's still considered new. But when it was founded, they made a really nice investment in the program and built a top-end, you know, well-engineered soundstage. In fact, I believe the engineer behind it was a retired Warner Brothers Studios engineer. So it's a first-class soundstage with editing facilities and grip electric cage and that sort of thing. So it's really unique in the high school environment.
It's incredible what you have to offer. And what we're going to be talking, and what really blows me away, actually, is that we're talking about high school level students. And by the time people get through with this program, I may get in trouble for this. They may not even need to go to a college level radio or TV or film program or vocational program like one would have to do in the past. Is this, in essence, how and why this came together?
Well, it's intentional. When I came into the school, it was at a transition point. The traditional film program was solid: screenwriting, cinematography, editing, you know, basically. And of course, the future is in digital media. So I looked at an opportunity here, and this had to do with the school as a whole. What I saw was an opportunity to basically create what I think of as the Juilliard for filmmakers. You know, Juilliard has a high school program, and it's a conservatory, and I saw the opportunity within an environment like this where the facilities were already top end, and you have seven different arts disciplines, which you need all of for filmmaking. You need theater, you need actors, you need musicians, graphic design, visual arts, and I saw an opportunity here. So my vision for the program was to make this a very, very high-end program for the most exceptional and talented students. I was in the film industry in L.A. for 24 years before I started teaching and before I started teaching college, and I didn't go to film school. I'd gotten a car, drove across the country to be a movie director.
Excellent.
Got there and discovered, oh, you're a woman, you don't get to direct.
Oh,
and
no.
So the good news was that I had to work my way up. I started on the crew side. My way up. I did become a director in the 90s, and all of that experience has turned out to be, I couldn't have a better background. Film school would not have been a better background for teaching because I've been on the crew side, I've been the writer, the director, I've done all of these things. So I brought all of my experience to the table into the teaching environment to build programs that will actually launch a career, you know, a young person's career.
Right,
I did this
at
first at the Savannah College of Art and Design on the college level, and then, you know, doing it here at Idlewild Arts. So the recruiting that I do on the staff level is mostly from the industry. I want individuals who have made their living in the industry, because that's a very different skill set. It's a different point of view. It's a different understanding.
It's a different mindset.
It's a different mindset. Yeah. And if I'm going to turn out students who are young professionals, then I have to have professionals teaching them. So we all look at it in the same way, with this understanding of what someone needs to be able to have a career in this profession.
At one point, to get into filmmaking or radio, or, you know, there were even broadcasting schools. There's more of those these days. But at one point, you would have to finish high school, either go to college or perhaps a vocational tech type of programming. And this really makes me think of a very specific vocational tech kind of program. That you don't have to be 18 or 19 before you start thinking about those options. You're getting it as you're developing. I mentioned the classes that are offered here and just how advanced this is. And this is really, I would say, a reflection of your experience. So you are teaching people. A lot of folks, sometimes when they come into filmmaking, they want to be a director. They have that vision. They have that art film pulling at them. But they don't understand that they have to be a grip. They have to help carry cables across the stage. What was it in the beginning stages? And what, as far as the digital world? Because surely you didn't just dive Or did you dive right into the deep end with everything offered?
Well, everything except digital. Now, when we say digital, what we're talking about is next year I'm offering a course in virtual reality. And it's VR 360. It's narrative-based filmmaking with, you know, the 360 camera, which is really traditional filmmaking with different equipment, right? And then we're building from that to, we'll go into Unity and start building a program in gaming, which will be gaming, animation, and VR. So that's the digital reality, I mean, the digital media side of the program. And I'm just now getting that off the ground. It took me 3 years to solidify the program, to align it with how the industry works today. When I arrived, it was a little bit dated. Mm-hmm. You have to really stay on top of that because the industry changing.
Oh, sure.
And also, you know, ultimately, you have to protect the fundamentals. You have to protect good writing, good storytelling. The equipment is going to keep changing. The platform is going to keep changing. I don't know what it'll be in 20 years or even 10 years.
Sure.
So you have to start off by having a really, really solid foundation in the traditional areas. I committed to narrative. We are a very small program. We have a very small staff. I can't teach everything, so I committed to narrative because another thing that I also look at, too, I think especially with this generation, you don't even know what they're going to ultimately be.
Yeah.
They may come in thinking they want to be a filmmaker, and 10 years down the road, they're in a completely different profession. So what are the skills that you can offer them in a film program that will work for them in a multitude of disciplines? You know, good storytelling, whether you're, you know, writing a grant proposal, you're trying to raise money for a project that's important to you, you have to be able to tell a story about the thing that you're doing. Secondly, the digital skill sets that are required. And then third, and you mentioned this, you touched on this, is teamwork. You know, I always say to my students, you know, filmmaking is a team sport, and your movie is only as good as your team.
Yeah.
So you may be brilliant, you may be a genius, but if you can't first pick out the other extraordinary individuals to be on your team and then communicate your vision to them, you won't have that great film.
Yeah.
So it's teaching communication skills. The kids that come in, you know, you were saying they all want to be directors, not necessarily anymore, because especially in digital media, they fall in love with highly specialized components of it.
The process.
Yeah, they do. Okay. They fall in love with that. And so I kind of make them all be writers and directors.
Oh, wow.
Because I feel like, you know, for them to be a good leader, they have to know what it means to, you know, have other people on their team. They have to know what that looks like. They have to have played that part. So they all come in and they do everything so that they have a really accurate understanding and perception of what it takes. And then also another important piece, too, that you have to be mindful of is that there's a difference between being a vocational school, a tech school, and being either a high school or a university or college. And the difference is in the content. You know, it's not about how well you can color balance a camera or how well you can color correct your film. It's not in the equipment. You know, the equipment are the tools, but not the content. So we focus very strongly on the content, and then we give them the training that's necessary to bring that content to the screen, you know, with whatever the equipment happens to be.
All of your seniors, they end up producing a film. You're not going to leave this program without producing a film.
Oh, it's much deeper than that. Every single student writes, produces, and directs a film every year.
Oh, wonderful.
So they arrive in the ninth grade. They arrive in the 10th grade. If they're there for 3 or 4 years, they've made 3 or 4 films. The really ambitious ones will make more than one film a year.
Nice.
I don't ask them to, I don't tell them to, but if they come to me and say, I want to make 2 films next year, I say, okay, you know, first step is writing 2 good screenplays, right?
Excellent.
And I have to say, one of the things about that, that is truly unique, even in certain college programs.
Mm-hmm.
Every student doesn't write and direct a film.
Right, right. Well, in the theater world, I mean, you've got, of course, some directors, some actors, some purely technicians.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's quite an actor versus techie kind of thing there.
Yeah.
But going back to the cooperative element that you were talking about in the team and recognizing everything that's involved, again, looking at this extensive offering of courses, and I should say it's just simply idlewildarts.org. Right? And
yes.
Then it's easy to springboard into the film and digital media portion of this. But if you look at the practicum, you've got all these wonderful screenwriting, shot design, the aesthetics of editing, and all this wonderful stuff, and then finally get to the practicum. And I'm going to quote it here. This course helps students develop the maturity and mundane skills necessary, because we're talking about maintaining the shop, leave it the way you found it, putting stuff away. It's dusting equipment. It's not the exciting stuff, but it's the real stuff.
Yeah. That's important. As a filmmaker myself, I have been in communities that were hostile to filmmakers, and they're hostile because the filmmakers who came before you didn't respect their community. They didn't take care of their property. They left it in bad condition. So that's part of being a filmmaker. That's part of the training. And also, you know, you find that if the students are required to take care of the facilities, they care more about it. And by the way, that's not a film department requirement. Every department in the school has practicum.
That's Annette Haywood-Carter, Idyllwild Arts Academy Film and Digital Media Department Chair. We'll have more with her just ahead. Later in the program, we'll hear from Sahar Khajanouri in conversation with Pete Sands of Black Kiss, one of the artists on the AUX, the music video service of First Nations Experience. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Again, let's touch on something that's coming up that's going to be brand new, and we alluded to it a second ago, the VR360 camera. Okay, we're talking about virtual reality, and I guess first and foremost that I want to say that this is going to be the first and only in the country, right, this program, and this is virtual reality filmmaking. VR360, can you talk about, this is a very specialized camera in and of itself and the type of things that you can do with it.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece of equipment. It's literally 360. So you have a camera that looks like a ball. It looks like a globe. Okay. And it records the 360 environment. So there are two aspects to virtual reality. One is narrative or documentary virtual reality filmmaking, where there's a lot of documentaries out there now, but not a lot of narratives. So the documentaries might be exploration of a museum, for instance, where you take the camera in and a person can actually walk through the museum.
Completely with the panning all the way around.
Yes, and I think people are familiar with that. You know, you just pan on your computer screen. So the first thing that we're doing is we're making narrative 360 films, which, you know, just requires you to think about, well, why would you shoot this? Why would this story be better in the 360 environment than in a traditional environment?
Nice.
So the equipment can be used for anything, but it has to be appropriate. So the first step for us is to do narrative VR 360, because it really is traditional filmmaking with the new equipment. And then, of course, you have to have your VR goggles to experience the film.
Sure.
So there's an interactive component for the audience. You have to look over your shoulder, and then that gets into sound design. What makes the person who's wearing the goggles turn around and look at what's going on behind them? So it's not just the visual, but it's also sound. There'll be something that causes them to turn. So I'm really excited about that part, because we'll be developing our sound design component to serve that and service that. And then once we have nailed that, which we'll do next year, then for the next year, I'll put the VR on the path of gaming. Now, that's a very different process, because it's all computer-based.
Okay.
And you tend to build your worlds inside the computer. So now at this point, you're in graphic design. So now we've crossed over into the visual arts department. So a lot of what we do in the film program is we're the intersection for all of the other disciplines at the school.
Okay.
So for instance, you get into gaming and you get into stop motion and you bring in dancers. You bring in dancers for some of that, for the creation of that material. If you're in just straightforward VR, you might bring in your theater students for acting and for voice acting.
Okay.
And also when you get into gaming, you bring in the visual arts program for animation, which is another piece that we will develop. You'll bring them in to do the artwork.
Nice, nice. One would guess that with this virtual reality, this VR 360 camera, I think that it would be easy for a person to lose track of narrative because they've got something so cool right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Matrix all over
you.
The first one. But again, your focus is on narrative films. You're not going to let somebody stop with the storytelling, because that's something actually very important that you touched on earlier. And you talked about storytelling, but you compared that very directly with writing a grant or very, you know, let's say ordinary type of things. There is still a storytelling aspect to it, or there ought to be. There better be, to make it more interesting and flowing. With that in mind, we were talking about films and the students producing at least one film every year. Film festivals, that's something else that goes on within the program. Talk about this for a bit, please.
Well, we've just started doing that. That was something that the previous chair was not doing. They weren't submitting films to festivals. So it's taken me a couple of years to get a body of work that could be dropped into the festival scene. What we're finding with our films is that they really are on a college level. They really are quite good. And so in the high school arena of competition, they're just hitting it out of the park. They're just, you know, winning right and left. But the most exciting thing for me recently is I had a student who submitted his film to an adult festival because he was 18 when he made the film. And this particular festival had an age cutoff. It wasn't high school versus non-high school. It was once you're 18, you're in the adult category.
Gotcha. Okay.
Oh. And so, and he was winning in the adult category. And I had this wonderful situation where an old friend of mine who I hadn't seen in years tracked me down through Facebook to tell me that, and this is a friend who's in his 50s, to tell me that his film had lost to an 18-year-old and that the only reason he was okay with that was when he looked it up and saw where this student went to school and then looked up the school and saw that I was working there. He said, I was happy that it was your student. I was happy with losing to one of your students. And to me, that was just the highest compliment because it was unsolicited. The student had done an excellent job, and people were appreciative of that. But that is the quality of what we're doing.
Yes.
Now, I will add one thing. The
Please.
Program is narrative, but if a student comes to me and says, I want to do a non-narrative film, if I have a student who really is an art filmmaker, I have one this year, I had two last year, and all they do is make art films.
Okay.
And that's more of a one-on-one mentoring. They're in the same classes, but they're not necessarily producing the narrative screenplay. They have to put things down in writing. It has to be on paper before it goes to the screen. But there's a very, very different process there. And the difference for me as a teacher is that if it's a piece of art, I really just get out of the kid's way. I make them articulate what they're trying to do. And they have to work within the same production structure as everyone else. You get X amount of time. You get X amount of equipment. This is your package. And this is your team. But I don't hover over them. And I don't even really give them notes in the editing process other than to say, well, I got bored when I got to there, but maybe that's just me. I don't make them change anything. Whereas with narrative, you know, there's a much more kind of directing them through the process.
Sure. Well, whether it's a very strict and linear or whether it's complete, one still needs to be able to articulate the abstract if that's what it is. You mentioned some of the films can be seen online.
Yes. If you go to idlewildarts.org and you navigate to the film and digital media page and click on gallery.
Okay. Wonderful.
So when you go to gallery, there are about six films posted there and you scroll down. We also do professional quality posters. These posters look like they came right out of Hollywood. I've got a lot of those online as well so that you can see what those posters are. I'm just really blown away with how talented these kids are. I asked them to make a poster and they come in with something that is so good. I just think they could also be winning awards for graphic design.
Again, so I have to stress that this is the high school level. If you're maybe just tuning in, we're talking about the Idlewild Arts Academy. So we're talking about grades 9 through 12. But it sounds like we're discussing a college program, and there's a lot to be said for this. It's very advanced, and certain aspects of it are the only ones of their nature in the country. So idlewildarts.org, once again, and then it's fairly easy to springboard into the various programs. When is registration, and how does one get into the programs? Is there an audition or portfolio process? How does this happen for a ninth grader?
Well, each department has their own audition requirements. So dance will have something that looks very different from theater or film or visual arts. The chair of each program is able to determine what those audition materials are. Mm-hmm. So you just go to the website and you just work your way through the prompts until you get to the requirements for application. What I'd like to add to this, there's several things that make this truly unique. Not only do we have the seven disciplines, it's a boarding school, and it's on this 250-acre campus, so it feels very much like a small college. When you arrive there, you've got your dorm cluster, you've got your academic buildings, you've got your arts buildings. We have just an absolutely stunning state-of-the-art concert hall. it's like its own little art center, the school, because every week there's anywhere from 1 to 5 different programs happening in the evening. It can be a recital, a concert, orchestra, a visual arts opening, film screening. So this is all going on this small campus. The other thing that makes it unique, when you compare it to other boarding schools, there aren't that many, I think, they're just a handful of arts boarding schools, is the rigor of the academic program. It's actually not an easy school because they take a full, rigorous academic program in the mornings, and then at 2 o'clock they go into their arts, and from 2 to 8 or 8:30 they're in their arts. And if you're a film student, on the weekends you're making films, right? So it's really for someone who is just passionate and determined and really, really wants this. It's an international environment. 50% of the students at Idyllwild Arts Academy are foreign. And in my department alone, I have a very small department, I have 11 countries in my department. And it's such an exceptionally kind of beautiful community of people, of artists who come together here, both the students and the teachers. People are here because they want to be here, which is not necessarily true of every boarding school, right? You know, people come here to pursue their passion, and they bond. In my department, I just look at these kids from 11 different countries, and right now I've only got 30 students in my program, and I've got 11 countries, and I look at them hanging out together on the soundstage and working together on their films, and you would think they had grown up together.
That's beautiful.
How close they are. So all of that enhances the experience. And, you know, with the academics, I'm bringing that back up again because the head of the school, Pam Jordan, she says, you know, smart artists make smart art. So sometimes, you know, it feels like maybe it's all a little bit too hard, right? Like maybe we should lighten up a little bit. But I don't think they want us to lighten up, you know? I think they want to meet these challenges. And then what it does is it sets them up to go off either straight into their profession. I think a lot of the dance students do that. I have the program designed in such a way so that the students could go straight into the industry. Sometimes it's hard to convince someone to hire an 18-year-old, and that's a whole other issue. But towards that, I'm also building a pipeline between Idyllwild Arts and Los Angeles. I have a lot of friends in L.A. in the industry, and it's a 2.5-hour drive from Idyllwild to L.A. So getting kids into internships and then getting them into the most prestigious film schools. It's, you know, those are two different paths, and the program is designed to put them on either of those paths, whichever one is where their heart is and where they want to go.
Again, it's almost a direct comparison to a college level, at least at the bachelor's level, where you're either preparing to go further into your master's or MFA or whatever terminal degree you may be looking for, or off into the professional track. So.
Yes, and in fact, the number one complaint that you hear from alumni from the Film and Digital Media program is that they get to college and they're taking classes that they've already had before they go, but I already know how to do this. And what I say to them is, yes, but of course your insight, your vision, your maturity is an evolving thing. I said the goal then is to make a more sophisticated film using the same tools.
They're forcing you to practice and you're making connections along the way. So. Okay, well, gosh, Annette Haywood-Carter, Idyllwild Arts Academy Film and Digital Media Department Chair. I really appreciate you coming in. This was really cool to hear about, and not just the stuff that I've been missing over the last 14, 15 years that this program's been around, but the virtual reality stuff, the gaming stuff. This is all coming up for the 2018-2019 year?
Yes, we start this in the fall. Our first VR class is in the fall, and the next year we'll go into gaming.
Wonderful. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
This was really nice.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Annette Haywood-Carter, Idyllwild Arts Academy Film and Digital Media Department Chair. Again, more at idyllwildarts.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. Up next, we have Sahar Khajnouri in conversation once again with Pete Sands of Blackus. You can find Pete on YouTube, also on The Aux, the music video service of FNX. That's at fnx.org/TheAux. That's AUX.
Tan 4
rubber ducky.
Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm Sahar Khajnouri. Tonight is Music in Conversation with Dark Country musician and filmmaker Pete Sands of Black Kiss. And you can find his and other artist music videos on the Aboriginal Unity Experience, the Indigenous music video series from FNX, fnx.org/theox. People were to watch your music videos, you know, you also get a feel for your style, your view, kind of viewing the world through Black Kiss vision.
That's a scary thought right there.
your videos have an interesting texture to them because you give a little taste of the Southwest and a little biker culture, a little something rebellious and dangerous at the same time, kind of teeter-tottering on these really soulful lyrics, and that really works.
You want to die, just want you to know that I did love you. The song kind of sigh.
We talk about music and the music that you're making and the music that you're performing. You just hear the music and you can feel the music, and it's something very different each time. Talk to me about the different musicians or the different instruments that you have incorporated into your dark country music style.
Right now I play with my buddy Renata Javanov, cello player, and she's been playing with me for about almost 2 years now, but even her joining me was something very different. To have that cello follow the haunting sounds of Blackis.
You say I'm as terrified and bucket of nets. I punched a first-class ticket straight to hell.
You know, it's the storytelling is what's, to me, is what's very important. So whatever instrument that I want to put on a song has to complement the story. I think it was the guitar player for Maroon 5, when they asked him, what is a good guitar player? What is a great guitar player? He says, a good guitar player can play all the notes, can play all over the frets. He says, but a great guitar player will serve the song. And from that, I knew exactly what he meant. So when I write a song, when I perform live, I like to have instruments and people who cater to the song, not try to shine on their own. Because as a collective, you have to be able to hold something together with all your hands included. And when one side falters, then it just unbalances everything. So I'm very careful about who I let enter my world in that sense. But I'm always open to try something new. You know, I keep that open mind. But I've had steel guitar players, cellos, violinists, harmonicas. Had an accordion player play with me for a while, drummers, other guitar players. But there's probably more things out there that I want that I haven't yet discovered. But it is always mixing it up is something I've always wanted to do. Because, you know, as an you feel like an outsider. I mean, I always felt like an outsider when I was younger. I was picked on a lot, bullied as well. Is that, you know, you try to collect things to try to make yourself normal. And in that sense, you collect things from different cultures or different things you see in magazines or movies or whatever you listen to, and you put that as a part of yourself to try and make yourself normal, but it makes you bloom to something else. And so I think that's why it's very important for me to mix it up, and I do it unknowingly sometimes.
Tell me, what was it like to meet your idol, Shooter Jennings?
I first met Shooter a couple years ago, and I wasn't really making music at the time. And he really encouraged me to try it. You know, everybody has a unique perspective on anything. I think it was back in 2010, I think, was when I met him. And that's when he encouraged me. And yeah, he gave me directions to where his father was laid to rest. And he says, go visit my father and see how you feel after that. And so I went a couple months later, and I stood there, you know, at the graveside of Waylon Jennings. And there's so many things there. People leave there, like CDs, you know, just stuff to honor the guy. And after that, I said, I got to give this a try. And so as the years passed, I would run into him every now and then. And we started building a repertoire, and it just got to the point to where he saw what I was becoming. He saw through Instagram, especially everything through Instagram. He saw the progress I was having, not only as a songwriter, but as an artist. And as you know, as an artist, if you're true to yourself and how honest you are with your fans and the people, other artists will gravitate towards you. Because you have something to offer more than just something superficial. So, and he's seen that now. And when I talked to him when I came to LA yesterday, he told me, he says, hey man, I can't wait to see you tomorrow. And it really doesn't click, it really doesn't dawn on me, because I just see them as friends. But when I sit back and really think about it, I think, like, a couple of years ago, you didn't know him, and you weren't an artist. And you always dreamed of playing and meeting your idols and people you've known, like Yellow Wolf and Shooter and Whitey Morgan, Randy Rogers. And I've played with all of them. And it just blows my mind. And sometimes it kind of scares me, I guess, because, you know, as a little Navajo boy growing up on the Navajo reservation, you never think, you dream of things, but you never really think that you would ever achieve such things. And meeting the filmmakers I've met, Oscar-winning actors and Oscar-nominated directors, it's like, and they know you, they know your name. It just blows your mind. It blew my mind. It just made me feel, I don't know, like I felt like blushing, I guess. I don't know. I felt embarrassed. I don't know why.
You know, Peter's a friend. And there's singers and then there's voices. And this is a voice. And the difference is, you know, you listen to a singer, but a voice is the soundtrack of your life. And that's what this guy is. I'm honored he asked me to to be here tonight and to introduce him and his band. And I can't wait to hear him. So here you go. Here's Peter Sands and Black Kiss.
It's one of those things where, you know, people tell you, you know, keep working on your dreams because you never know what could happen. And that's true, you know. I came from such a small world, but my creativity was something that was more than just where I grew up from. And people like Shooter who have encouraged me and supported me, you know, behind the scenes, you know, I don't really put it out there all the time. You know, Shooter Jennings calls me and whatever. But, you know, because I want to build it on my own. I want to build this Blackest with people who I came up with, who I built with. And that's very important to me because, you know, they were there when none of this was here, when we were just unknowns.
On a long, lonesome road from Boulder to Tucson, I find myself dragging my feet, even with the sun pushing me away.
People invest their time in me, especially when fans come out to watch and see, because they're taking time out of their lives to come see me. And that's, you know, you gotta respect that. And I respect that so deeply. And I'm extremely thankful for that, especially for the people who invest money in me. That is ultimate form of faith. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, some of them don't have a lot of money, don't have a lot to give, but they give what little they have to what I believe in. And that is something that I can probably never pay back. You know, it's, yeah.
That amount of faith and support in you from your fans is most definitely priceless, as is projects where you are tapping into a more cultural background.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking about your work with Mr. Tahani and that close relationship you have. And that's something that, you know, directors are not able to build because you're inside the circle, you're mm-hmm. inside the community, making films with and about the community, I think is really unique. Tell me more about your about your project with Joe.
Joe Tahani Jr. is a White Mountain Apache crown dancer singer. He comes from a long line of crown dancing and crown dancing singers, and he's a two-time Grammy nominee and very powerful voice, man. He has a voice that can move you. And for him to give me a chance to sing with him, I was a huge fan of Joe Tahani for years. And clan-wise, we're related because he's half Navajo. And so clan-wise, he's my older brother. And so when we got to know each other, he was one of those guys that had faith in me when I first met me. And he says, you know, you have a different, unique way of playing your music and being the person you are. It's going to be tough for you to find that audience. But once you do, it'll be dedicated, loyal fans and supporters. And he identified that immediately because he's seen as an outsider as well, but he reaches so many people. And I'll tell you, the first show I ever played with him was at in Monument Valley, Utah. That's the first time I ever sang with him, was in Monument Valley, Utah. And after the show, it was quite something to see people line up such a long ways just to get a prayer with him. So these shows that he plays and people wait for him just to get a prayer with him, he'll stand there and he'll pray. Sometimes it'll take 2 to 3 hours before we can leave after the show because he'll stand there and do these little prayers for people and give him little blessings just to, you know, to show appreciation for people who come out for him. And seeing things like that and how he treats his fans, it showed me that there's no excuse for me not to do that. Taught me a lot, you know, and he's still going, man. He's still got that voice. He's got so many songs. He actually gave me a drum of my own so I can practice at home. So I got an authentic Joe Tahani drum.
I'm jealous.
If I get desperate, I'll put on eBay.
No. I'll bid.
Yeah, so, you know, Joe is a good guy, man. He's had some struggles he's gone through, but he's overly positive and he doesn't let anything negative get him down. And that's what I really appreciate him showing me, is how to treat the fans and how to show appreciation and just to try to remain positive through the negativity that tries to bring people down.
You have the native sound, but it's not overbearing, and it's not like you're trying to overdo it. Like, yes, I get it, you're native. But it's like a whisper of culture and a feel, that country feel and that drifter feel all at the same time. But I have to kind of illustrate to the people who are listening to this interview, if they could catch a glimpse of your jewelry, they would be just as envious as I am. Wow. You were playing the guitar yesterday and you were strumming, and I was watching your hands, and I could just see from the light, the stage light, how, you know, each ring was shining. What kind of stones do we have there? So they're set in metal, so we got some turquoise.
I got some rings from my friend Travis Tutt and Tyler Johnson, and this bracelet has been in our family for years. And a lot of the other rings were given to me as gifts from jewelry makers, and some are from fans. And the turquoise rings are made all by Tyler and Travis. And it's, you know, it's, I never wore rings ever when I was younger or even just recently. And I got my first ring actually from my younger brother, who's a wolf, had a wolf on it, and he gave it to me. And I wore it. And then just pretty soon people started gifting me rings. And I had a whole bunch of rings, but like, I was in a car accident a couple of years ago in Salt Lake, and you know, my car was totaled and everything, and I lost a lot of stuff in there, but it's just stuff, you know. I'm still alive. That's what counts. But after that, I realized, you know, there's power in the stones. You know, there's, you know, as Native American culture, turquoise has power to it. And when I started getting these rings from these guys, and it just it just gives you a connection to a past that, because they hand make all these, and some of them have, these are so much intricate detail. I just wonder, like, how do you do that? And Travis made me this Slamerican Sands ring with the lightning bolt on it, and Tyler gave me this first piece, my first turquoise piece, is in my middle finger. I don't want to flip the camera off, but in my middle finger, that was my first turquoise piece he gave me when I played a show out in Phoenix. We actually bartered, so I can't say he gave me. The Indian way of doing things, we bartered. And ever since then, it's been a good relationship with those guys, and they're tremendous, tremendous silversmiths. Great people as well, great family guys, and big supporters of mine, and I support them as well. And I can't think of not wearing these at all now. I wear them all the time, even when I play. And when people see me play after the show, they just ask me, where do you get these rings, man? Where do you get these things? But I always tell people who want Native American jewelry, it's going to cost a lot. Is, you know, it's the real authentic stuff. You know, if you want the real deal, you have to pay the real prices.
Absolutely.
And people always ask me, where do I find Native American jewelry? And I always tell them, go drive through a reservation or drive by it.
Bravo.
And buy it from the people who sell it themselves. You know, that's the most important thing. I mean, we got social media now. We got a lot of silversmiths who are kind of Instagram celebrities now, mm-hmm. and they got some tremendous work, and there's so many out there that even I haven't found yet, and you know, hopefully I will find them and meet them and barter. But I'm very, very thankful for the rings I got.
They're gorgeous. I love them.
Thank you.
So I know that you have a new album coming out. When does that come out, and how many songs can we expect?
Well, the album is going to be called Dark Side of Country, and it's going to be totally different. We started laying down the tracks 2 weeks ago. We're going to have a total of 12 songs on it. I plan on releasing it on January 26, 2018, and that's going to be the first disc. There's going to be two discs. The first disc is going to be acoustic. The second disc is going to be electric. So the second disc is going to be more rock-oriented. And the first disc would be more country, acoustic feel to it. So it's made a total of like 24 songs altogether.
Wow, you're doing it big.
Yeah, we're aiming high this year.
I dig that.
It's a dream, you know. After the album's done, you know, I can die a happy man, because I would have done everything I wanted. And I'm in a place where I'm happy, and you know, it's good right now.
Well, I heard myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar stain. Tried and kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt. I won't let you down, I won't make you hurt.
Okay. Inquiring minds want to know, and maybe it might be just mine. Will we see or hear a Blackhead song in Navajo?
That's actually a lot of the main requests I get from people. And I say, you know, nothing's out of the question. It's a possibility.
Good answer.
Who says I haven't written some already?
Can we get a sneak peek?
I don't have my guitar with me, so...
I tried.
Yeah. It's I'll probably release like a three or four song Navajo song in, you know, Blackest. I'm not gonna redo old Blackest song, but I'm gonna write new songs in Navajo, and I hope people like it. Yeah.
Kaden. With that old Blackest savoir faire, Pete. Yeah, long. You came in, you took time, you're sharing previous projects and what you've got going on. So thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Everyone I know goes away in the end.
That's Sahar Kajanori and Music in Conversation with singer-songwriter and filmmaker Pete Sands. More at blackkissdrifters.com. You can also find Pete on YouTube and on the AUX, the music video service of FNX, First Nations Experience. Go to fnx.org/theAUX. That's AUX.
If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself, and I would find a way.
And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Idlewild Arts Academy Film and Digital Media Department Chair Annette Haywood Carter, Pete Sands, also Sahar Kajanori, and with FNX, Frank Blinkett. Here at KBCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Iselle Quapio, Jessica Greenwell, and KBCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KBCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year, any time of the day at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.